Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, who is away this week at the Sun Valley Writers Conference in Idaho. Thank you for spending part of your day with us. Coming up later on the show, we are celebrating the return of live theater. Yay! First, we'll get a preview of New York Theater Workshop's upcoming season with literary director and dramaturg Aaron Malkin. Then we'll speak with the creators behind Semblance, a new immersive theatrical installation at New York Theater Workshop that examines society's perceptions of Black women. And later, the off-Broadway musical sensation Stomp is back. Co-founder and percussionist Luke Cresswell stops by to discuss the show's return to the stage. That's all on the way, so let's get started. A new documentary on HBO tells the story of Woodstock 99. That's the 1999 three-day music festival held in upstate New York, a festival that was supposed to be an anniversary celebration for the original and often idealized Woodstock of 1969. But what was billed as a weekend of counterculture and free love a la 1960s devolved into mayhem, from leaked sewage to arson, riots, and sexual assault. Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage is the first HBO Music Box series being produced by Bill Simmons. It's the first documentary of that series. And it features riveting and at times infuriating interviews with the festival's organizers, performers, music journalists, and attendees. It comes out on Friday, and we're joined now by director Garrett Price. Garrett, welcome to All of It.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca.
Great having you. And listeners, we want to hear from you. Did you attend Woodstock 99? We want to hear about your experience. Did it live up to your expectations? Or was it a nightmare? Was it not as bad as everyone says it was? Call us, 646-435-7280. Again, 646-435-7280 to share your Woodstock 99 story. So, Garrett, you start the doc by saying that it would have been very easy to make this documentary more like of a comedy making fun of the late 90s. But then you say it actually ends up being more of a horror movie. That's a really ominous way to start. Why?
You know, I think it would have been too easy making this as a comedy. I think people almost expect that. But, you know, as I started digging into the story and talking to tons of people that were either attendees or participated working the festival, or, you know, the musicians themselves really kind of progressed like the structure of a disaster or a horror film as that weekend went on. It almost worked as a three-act structure from Friday through Sunday. And I found it really fascinating and scary, but also important to kind of talk about again, because I feel like the festival has been kind of swept under the rug over the years. I was amazed by how many people to this day confuse Woodstock 99 and Woodstock 94. It also was going to allow me to do something that I really wanted to do and kind of use this festival as a lens into the culture and the kind of the socio-political context surrounding this event in the late 90s and going into the new millennium. And that's what really excited me in making this film.
Yes, take us back to 1999 and give us kind of a snapshot of the culture in the United States.
Yeah, you know, Woodstock 99 happened in late July. 2 months before was the Columbine Massacre. You kind of have this hysteria of Y2K going on at this time. The music industry itself was changing. Napster started to rear its head, so that was kind of changing the way, you know, the industry itself worked and the future of what was going on, the internet boom, we were in full force. You know, it was a culture in the era of Girls Gone Wild and Maxim mm-hmm. magazine and FHM, Clinton Lewinsky scandal. So it felt like it was kind of a disposable time for women at this time also. So I just found it so fascinating, all these kind of threads in culture from the late 90s that you could kind of draw to where we are today and a lot of the societal issues and conversations we're having. And that, you know, using this festival as a kind of a mirror to our culture, I thought was really interesting and kind of like the original Woodstock did in 69 and hold that festival up. And it kind of is a mirror to that counterculture youth, generation going on at the time. And that's what Woodstock stories are so interesting, I think.
Totally. And again, you mentioned the 1994 because I honestly forgot about everything about 1999. I mean, I was a bit young at the time, but I really didn't know so many of these stories because there was Woodstock 1994 that was, you know, by all accounts, successful, right? And that led organizers, including Michael Lang, Woodstock founder, to say, you know, let's do this again every few years for a new generation of young people. So what was like Woodstock 94 like?
Yeah, you know, if you look at that lineup, there was much more crossover between the 69 lineup and kind of the acts of the early 90s. And I think you could market toward that kind of baby boomer generation that are familiar with the original to this kind of Generation X, I guess, of the early 90s. And mm-hmm. you know, I use this film to really kind of look at the 90s. It almost feels like it lives in two sections under one umbrella. If you look at the early 90s, you have bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam and hip-hop acts like Tribe Called Quest, where there's almost this idealism in the music. You thought change was happening. And we kind of start to shift from that idealism to nihilism in the music as the decade progresses. And I thought that was really interesting. And I again, wanted to use this story to kind of explore that and see why this shift was happening, you know? And I feel like it gave me an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, and we'll keep talking about that. But we actually have a caller already, Michael from Manhattan in line one. Michael, you were there. Thank you for calling All of It. And what was the experience like for you?
Well, I was a senior in high school, and my best friend and I decided to go. I had a tent. I was going camping a lot at that time, so we drove up to Woodstock. It was near Woodstock. I remember going by the original site. I never really remember being up there before. But we found the spot, pitched the tent, and then made our way to the stage. And I remember seeing G-Love and Special Sauce, but to get to the stage, there were so many people that you literally had to crowd surf. So I switched my wallet to my front pocket and surfed over hundreds upon hundreds of people who just passed you forward. And being a kid, it was amazing. That was Thursday, though. By Saturday, a sewage leak started showing up near where the tent was. And it was getting hotter and hotter. There was less and less water. Of course, brought water bottles and bought stuff. Our money was starting to run a little low, and just finding anything decent to eat or water to drink was becoming scarce. So really, I mean, there was drugs, there was alcohol, there was sex everywhere, and we just packed up our stuff Sunday afternoon and left because we were just so tired and dehydrated.
And Michael, when you think about it now, do you remember it kind of fondly, like, oh, that thing I did when I was in high school?
Yes. I mean, I remember, being a little pervert and taking pictures of everything going on. And it was just, I mean, it was fun. It was love. It was rampant mayhem. But then I remember leaving the tent there and just because it was covered in sewage and mm-hmm. there was no way I was taking that away and just getting out of there because it looked like it was getting worse. And then later on the news, I remember seeing the stories, the fires and everything else. And it was just too much.
But Michael, thank you so much for calling All of It and sharing your story. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with director Garrett Price about the HBO documentary Woodstock 99, Peace, Love and Rage, out on Friday. I'm Rebecca Ibarra filling in for Allison Stewart, and you're listening to All of It. Garrett, there's a lot to get to that, you know, Michael mentioned, and that your documentary really gets into all of that. But I want to first kind of talk about the town where it took place, right? It was held in upstate New York in the town of Rome. Tell us about Rome, New York, for people who might be unfamiliar with it. You know, what did a music festival mean for it?
It meant a lot. You know, Rome was a military town. They had this Air Force base up there, Griffiths, that was basically, you know, the main, you know, place for people working, and it brought, you know, it meant so much to the economy of the town. And then during realignment in the early 90s, the base shut down and they lost lots of jobs. A lot of people moved out of Rome. And, you know, I spoke with the mayor of the time, who's now a state senator, Joe Griffo, and he saw this opportunity of Woodstock 99 to really kind of uplift the spirit of this kind of down and out community. And he was excited. And they had this base that was basically abandoned at the time, that there was hopes to turn it into something. Mm-hmm. And when Michael Lang and John Scher were trying to find another location for Woodstock 99, you know, the base felt ideal to them because one of the biggest issues of past Woodstocks was gate crashing, people sneaking into the concert. So even the success, or, you know, or the mythological success of the previous two, they still lost money as far as ticket sales go. You know, the first Woodstock basically became a free concert, so famously shown in the documentary. And then the second one, people found ways to break in too. So, you know, I think what's better security than a military base?
And this was huge, right? You know, I mean, it was massive. It's described as like a little city.
Absolutely. But also, you know, it's basically runways and concrete runways. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of opportunities for shade. There's a hangar. The stages were built about a mile apart from each other also. So this is one of the hottest weekends of the year in upstate New York. And it, again, I mean, I know that's out of their control, but at the same time, you know, this is a time where, you know, I think corporations and capitalism started to rear their head, and, you know, they're charging $4 for a bottle of water at the time. Food's very expensive, and you got a lot of kids that came to this, not really understanding, you know, that I don't think they were going to be taken care of as well as they thought they would be in this venue.
Let's talk about Woodstock 1969. And I want to play a clip from the doc, and we're going to hear some of your interview subjects first talking about Michael Lang, the organizer of Woodstock, and then the other Woodstocks, 94, 99. And then we're going to hear about Woodstock 1969 itself, the original Woodstock. Here we go.
Michael Lang is who I call the Willy Wonka of Woodstock. He's this guy who's eternally boyish. He's presiding over this fantasy land that every generation of kids wants to visit. But if you spend more than a couple of minutes at the chocolate factory, you realize that it's not the idyllic utopia that it presents itself to be.
The thing about the Woodstock mythology is I feel like people are being selective about how they're choosing to remember what happened to suit their own ends. And the way in which we choose to romanticize it has everything to do with who's telling stories.
Unlike the prevailing lore would have it, Woodstock 69 was anything but peace, love, and, you know, 3 days of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was a mess. There were riots. The U.S. Army had to airlift supplies in. People died.
Garrett, who was responsible, according, you know, to your opinion and your reporting, for perpetuating this idyllic Woodstock 69 story?
I think you have the guiltiest party is the documentary that came out in 1970, because it kind of captured this idyllic event, these beautiful, like, bucolic vistas of Yasker's farm, you know, this counterculture coming together to listen to music for truthfully a weekend of peace, love, and rock and roll. And then it's, you know, in talking to the promoters, they talk about, you know, after they watched that people watched that documentary, people almost believed they were at Woodstock themselves. You know, they had 500,000 people there, but by all accounts, people talking about it, you'd say there's 2 million people that went to Woodstock. And, you know, it's just became ingrained in culture. you know, through the 70s, 80s, even into the 90s. You know, it's almost folklore being passed down. You know, myself, my parents came of age at that time, and this is the documentary they shared with me. We had the album in my house. So it's something that, you know, was passed down from generation to generation, this the stories of Woodstock and how much it meant to, you know, America and this change happening in America. But again, as we know, you know, the documentary captured all the good things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very romanticized. And there were some tragedies and some horrific moments that happened at the original, too, that, again, not until really digging into this film was I even that aware of. And I think it'll shock a lot of people, too.
It's so interesting because, you know, there's a documentary out now called The Summer of Soul. And for our listeners who might not have seen it yet, you know, the doc is all about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, which was an event filled with stars, you know, B.B. King, Nina Simone, Stevie Wonder. But it was in a way erased from the popular culture narrative and overshadowed by Woodstock 69. So how does that make you think about the stories you choose to tell and who you choose to feature?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it's like for this one, you know, this is a time I came of age in the late 90s. You know, mm-hmm. I was a sophomore in college in Texas, vividly remember glued to the television watching the pay-per-view of this event unfold before my eyes. And, you know, at the time, it was chaotic, it was crazy, but I had more FOMO than like thinking, oh my gosh, this thing's horrible, you know? So it wasn't really until years later did I start digging in and kind of realize the issues at hand, not only at the festival itself, but kind of in our culture at this time. And really, again, these threads of that time to where we've kind of moved to today. And that's what got me excited in telling the story. And also, you know, I think what I hope people get out of this is I think pull people in with the nostalgia of this time, like it did with me originally. I think people will be engrossed and engaged and entertained. But at the same time, you know, like myself, kind of self-reflect and reckon with how people acted at a time, you know, I came of age. And myself, too, was probably guilty for some of these things. And I think it'll be a learning experience. And I really try not to put blame on the thing, people, or specific things that, you know, that caused the outcome. I just lay out all the facts, you know, as I discovered them in people's stories and lots of different points of views, and I give everyone a chance to speak, you know. And that was my goal, and I think it's up to the audience to kind of think about and, you know, kind of conclude what caused it to kind of go out of control at the end.
And again, listeners, we want to hear from you. Did you attend Woodstock 1999? What was your experience? Call us 646-435-7280. Again, 646-435-7280. We are speaking with director Garrett Price about his new documentary out on HBO on Friday, Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage. And we'll continue this conversation and take your calls after a quick break. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and we are talking to Garrett Price, director of a new documentary on HBO out on Friday called Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage. Garrett, I want to play a little bit more of the documentary. So there's an interview with the musician Moby, and he says the reason he agreed to perform in Woodstock 99 was because of that almost, you know, mythical status that we talked about Woodstock 1969. But let's listen to Moby describe arriving at Woodstock 1999.
I remember I looked at the lineup and I was like, what is this? Like, how did this happen? How is this called Woodstock? It would have made so much more sense if it had been called like Army Base Rock 99 featuring Limp Bizkit. There is a sixth sense that you develop when you spend your life like going to nightclubs, going to venues. Like I can tell you 100 feet away what the energy in that venue is gonna be like. Just you develop it after decades of being around venues. We got off the bus and I was like, something's not right. And this was the first day. And I was just like, something you could just tell. And like, I started walking through the crowd and like everybody was angry. and everybody was hot and everyone was complaining, and it had only been open for 6 hours. And it was already off the rails.
Garrett, there are two things there that I want to get to, the lineup and the concert goers. So let's start with the lineup. Give us a sense of who was there performing.
Yeah, you know, this is the height of this kind of genre of rap rock, new metal. So you had a kind of bands at the height of their career, like Limp Bizkit, Korn, Rage Against the Machine. You also had hard rock acts like Metallica and Megadeth, and you had some hip hop like Insane Clown Posse. You had Kid Rock, and you also had, you know, kind of sprinkled throughout that weekend, you had three female acts: Alanis Morissette, Jewel, and Sheryl Crow. And then you had, you know, you had some more like traditional kind of acts that would feel appropriate to the Woodstock brand of the time, like I guess Dave Matthews Band and Counting Crows, and as the caller said, G-Love and Special Sauce. So it definitely on paper looked like it was who was at the top of the charts in the late 90s, which also says a lot about the state of music at the time, which I found so interesting. And, you know, and I think this is also a case study on that and how music was evolving of the time. But these bands were huge. And to me, I was more interested, I don't have anything against those genres of music, also specifically new metal. I was more interested in why that was connecting with so many people at that time. And we kind of break that down and explore it in the documentary.
I want to get to a couple callers. Let's go to Jason in Springfield, New Jersey on line 3. Jason, thank you for calling All of It. Tell us a little bit about your experience in about 30 seconds.
Hey there. I just remember it was hot, really hot, and it was concrete runways that people were just laying out on. There was no shade. There was no trees. There was nowhere to get a reprieve. And I just remember trying to get water, and it was $4 a water, which was astronomical at the time. I remember people were arriving early, and I arrived on Thursday. There was so much traffic getting in. I'll always remember there was a tour van. I think it was a Godsmack tour van that was driving next to us, and we were inching our way in. When we got in, we just tried to find a place to camp. And I just remember Friday night when the music started, I saw Korn, and it just seemed so aggressive. It was crazy. By Saturday afternoon, the heat was just so unbearable that I didn't even pack up. I just left and ended up watching the fires from CNN. But it was a scary scene. It was just, like I said, hot and no water.
Wow. Jason, so thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. And I want to go to another caller, Brian in Morris County on line 4, because I believe he has something to say about those fires. Brian, thanks for calling All of It. Share your story with us.
Hi. Yeah. I had was telling the screener, I had a really great weekend. I didn't really witness any violence. I just got lucky. One thing, when we walked up to the gate, there was nobody taking tickets, so we walked right in. So what you were saying about gate crashers before, everybody was just walking right in. But yeah, to the fires, the last night, it's something I will never forget. I was in that field with hundreds of thousands of people. The Chili Peppers are playing, and we looked back, and there was all these 18-wheelers, I guess, with supplies and stuff in them, and they just started lighting them on fire, and it wasn't even a bonfire. I mean, it was 100-foot flames coming out. As far as I know, nobody was injured, but it was just incredible electric scene, closing night.
Brian, was it scary or exciting or both?
Like I said, it was really exciting. I mean, the Chili Peppers had just whipped everybody into a frenzy, and then this huge fire breaks out. And I didn't see any violence. I didn't feel threatened. And we were in a huge field. Like the previous caller said, there was concrete everywhere. So it wasn't going to start a forest fire or anything. But it was exhilarating. It was a night to remember.
Brian, thank you so much for calling all of it. And again, we are speaking with director Garrett Price about his upcoming documentary on Woodstock 99. Garrett, those are kind of two, you know, different experiences, right? And what does that say, you know, what does that say to you? Comment on their experiences.
Absolutely. What I found so fascinating, it's such a polarizing event. I talked to tons of attendees that had the time of their life, while I talked to others that had a much different experience. That's what makes it such a, again, it's such a fascinating case study. But I do think it's really important to bring up the issues that happened there, because even mm-hmm. I even had people that worked on my film that attended Woodstock 99. And up until we started working on this, or they started working on this, they kind of, like that second caller, they thought it was one of the best weekends of their life. It meant a lot to them, you know, as kids. But as they started digging in with this film with me, and they started seeing some of the issues and some of the tragedy, real-life tragedy started occurring over that mm-hmm. weekend to other people, you start to kind of sympathize with that and understand. And then you mix that with the cultural context and kind of some of the toxicity going on in our culture at the time. It makes you really kind of reckon and self-reflect on that time. And I think that's okay. I think you can still have the best, you know, an amazing time, as long as you kind of realize some people didn't have that same experience, I think.
And one of the things you're talking about is there was actually a lot of sexual assault, you know, that happened during that festival. And in one of the most, for me, shocking, but also just depressingly predictable interviews in the documentary, one of the promoters of the festival blames women who were naked or topless for being sexually assaulted. What was that like listening to that response? I believe that it was John Scher. Tell me if I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah. You know, I was very thankful John and Michael both participated. You know, I told them I want to give them a platform to tell their side of the story, because people have lots of different, there's lots of finger pointing going on in the story of Woodstock 99. And it's something John has gone on record saying in the past. And I don't think it's just singular to John. I think it kind of represents an attitude to a whole generation, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it represents what a lot of people feel. And I think that, you know, one of the themes of this movie are kind of power dynamics of the late 90s, whether it's generational or gender or racial or class. And I think Woodstock 99 kind of brings all of those to the forefront of what was going on in 1999 at the end of the century. I found it fascinating, and I know it's tough to watch, but it's something they believe. And I hope in context, you know, especially John, in context of this film, it will help him, you know, it might change his mind a little bit. I don't know. Hmm. But again, I'm just laying out the facts and my interviews as a documentarian as objectively as possible, you know? So, it's an exploration of this time. And again, that's why I think it was so important to bring up, you know, Girls Gone Wild and this attitude towards women in the late 90s. And this is kind of one of the dangers of this, like, rose-tinted nostalgia and, you know, selling it and packaging it of the late 60s. So you have these kind of countercultural ideals of free love and kind of some of this toxic culture of the late 90s. And this is where it can get really dangerous, I think. And I think it shows as this film progresses.
Well, it is a fascinating documentary. I've been speaking with director Garrett Price about the HBO Music Box series documentary Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage, out on Friday. Garrett, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Hey, thanks, Rebecca, for having me and spreading the word.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.